Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
Now, for many people conceived using a donor, the pain of not knowing their biological parent or half-siblings can leave a lifelong mark. And I'm joined in the studio by Louise McLaughlin. She's a journalist and the host of the podcast You Look Like Me, it's a great name, which talks about identity issues and indeed the heart of family secrets that comes from donor conception. She is also campaigning for legal changes in Ireland so that people can identify who their biological parent is. Good morning, Louise McLaughlin.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in for this to share this story, because it is an intimate and it's a deep, meaningful conversation, really, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Before we come to that story about how you come to be born, tell us a little bit about yourself and your life today. You're a journalist.
Yes, I'm a journalist. I freelance at many, many different places. I cover normally international news. But this is a story that I found myself covering more and more in recent years. It's obviously something very personal to me, but DNA secrets, they just have so much at their heart. And I think when people hear the phrase donor conception, people can turn off because it's not a phrase that sounds necessarily interesting, but people are fascinated by DNA stories and DNA secrets.
Sure, yeah.
And all of this is at the heart, you know, who are you? Where do you come from? Who is your family? All of these things tie into this story of donor conception. And they're very, very personal for the people who are affected and people who don't actually have the answers to these questions a lot of the time.
It's extraordinary. How do you find out about your own birth? You're very young.
So I found out, I was told, when I was 13. Mm-hmm. And at the time, growing up in Ireland, I had never heard the phrase donor conception before, let alone thought that it was something that could refer to me. And it would be, you know, over a decade before I knowingly met someone who was donor conceived. Obviously, I may have come into contact with people before that, but, you know, it was not a thing that people were speaking about. If you used a donor, you didn't necessarily tell anyone, even friends, close friends, family often didn't know. And so I think growing up around that and not being kind of open necessarily with that information, it's difficult. And it is improving. People are talking about their own fertility struggles. And off the back of that, I think donor conception is becoming normalized. But it is something that donor conceived people struggle with. They're not necessarily forthcoming about their origins. And we still exist in a situation where many parents don't actually tell their children that they are donor conceived. So we have, you know, again, the figures, we don't actually have the exact figures, but in Ireland it is thousands, if not tens of thousands of people who are donor conceived. Mm. Many of them, if not more than half, considerably more than half, do not know that they are donor conceived. And we live in a situation where, you know, it's right after Christmas, people get DNA kits for fun as gifts.
They do. The genealogical research.
Exactly.
And you're related to someone across the world and so on.
Yeah, exactly. People think that they're doing this to find out that, you know, a grandparent's from Scandinavia. And instead, they're finding out that actually the man who brought them up might not be their biological father. So now more than ever, as we move away from the shame and the guilt that used to be associated with donor conception, still is to a degree because it's tied in with infertility, we need honesty, because people are finding out this information just by chance, or they're being told later in life. And having spoken to many donor conceived people, when you find out this information later in life, it pulls the rug out from underneath you. It changes everything. And people deserve to know the truth.
You find out very young, as you say, I think you're 13, you said. And like most of the, because it's fertility issues, it's people like yourself born in the 90s. What was your reaction?
Yeah, I mean, it was a huge shock, obviously. And when you speak to people around the world who are donor conceived, we all kind of say the same thing. You know, people report looking into the mirror and just not knowing where half of them comes from. But what really was an issue for me when I found out I was donor conceived was there was no path for me to discover who my biological father was.
Right.
So,
and by the way, we should point out you're growing up in a loving, stable household.
Oh my God, my parents are absolutely amazing. And, you know, I am so grateful for the fact that they told me, because the guidance at the time across the board, you know, UK, Ireland, was just don't tell. you can get away with it.
And that guidance comes from?
That was coming from clinics.
From the clinics.
Yeah, that was coming from the industry. And thank God they told me, because as I just said, you know, you find this thing out later in life by chance many, many times. And it is more soul destroying when you find out by chance, because this is a conversation that needs to come from parents, I truly believe. And that's what people tell me when I speak to them.
So what the crisis for you, is it an identity thing?
It's a right to information. So there are so many issues when you don't have this information. You know, there's health ramifications. If you don't know you're donor conceived, you're going into a medical appointment and you're handing over false medical history. You're saying, this runs in my family on this side.
I see.
And, you know, cancer is on this side. And it might not be.
Or biologically related to that.
Or you're missing something that needs to be flagged. If you don't know you're donor conceived, you're handing over false information. Mm. There's also things, you know, thank God Ireland now has a limit on how many offspring can come from a donor. That wasn't always the case. You used to be able to just donate. But even still, even with a limit, donors, you know, especially sperm donors, because, you know, you can donate probably more quickly and get numbers up. You know, offspring is growing up in a small area of the same age. And if you don't know your donor conceived, you're interacting with potential half siblings and you don't know they're your half siblings. You could be in the same school as them. You could be in the same netball team as them. Mm. I mean, it's dangerous. It's really dangerous.
You could end up dating them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I don't want to go in with scare tactics because that's, you know, a big headline. But it does happen. And it has happened. And donor-conceived people have been interviewed having had intimate relationships with half-siblings.
This news you got at 13, it seems to change the course of your life in many ways, doesn't it? You're a journalist now. Do you think you would have become a journalist? Because it involves, you set out on this path of research and tracking down your biological father.
Yeah, I definitely, I was a journalist regardless. This was not something that I spoke about. You know, I found my first match, my half-sister, I think around 7-8 years ago. You know, I went through a huge chunk of life without any information. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, that was because the clinics chose not to have that available. The law now says that when you get to age 18, you can find out the identity of your donor. And that's in the UK first, that's Ireland and now followed suit. So that's since 2020.
That's quite new here, yes.
Yes. So it's new, but it's also
not full identification of the
parent? It is, yeah. Okay. But it's also not enforced. So you think, like, that's from conceptions from 2020. So we're not going to see the impact of this law until the late 2030s.
Oh, I see. Yes, okay.
You know, and I'm here as a donor conceived person who was deprived of information, who had to take to DNA testing sites, who found my biological father around 5 years ago, and have found 7 or so half siblings since. I was forced to do that myself. I went through a decade and a half without any answers. I don't want people to have to go through that. And I think this law change in Ireland is a step in the right direction. Absolutely. But why are we depriving people of that information until they're 18? I know how it felt to sit with that information at age 13 and not have it until I was 26. You know, but the teenage years were the hardest. And I don't think that we should be inflicting, like, legally, that waiting period on donor-conceived people who, you know, ideally they would know from birth these days. That is the guidance. We would definitely recommend telling your child that they are donor-conceived from day one. If you haven't, do it today, do it tomorrow. Do it as soon as possible. But with that knowledge, you're then waiting until you're 18. I've spoken to donor-conceived people who did find a biological parent, only to discover they passed away a month before they were discovered.
Really?
And this law is setting people up for those circumstances. You know, this will happen. With a law like this in place, things like that will happen. And we just need openness, honesty, identification from day one.
What about the rights of the person who've donated the sperm? Because obviously they're needed, aren't they, for people who have fertility issues?
Absolutely.
They are doing a good thing,
yeah.
Essentially.
100%.
And do they still have the right to not be found?
They are fully identifiable now. That is what they're signing
That's
up for.
Change.
The issue is, you know, you have recipient parents and you have a donor entering into this contract. They're adults. They're making an informed decision and they know what they're signing up for. The donor-conceived person is not part of this contract. They're not signing anything. They're the most affected person and they have no oversight into what's going down. They have to be prioritised as the main responsibility. The duty of care must always, always, always be to them. Yeah. Because at the end of the day, the goal of parents with using a donor, single parents, you know, whatever the case may be, and fertility clinics should not be, the goal should not be to put a baby in the arms of the parents and say, job done. The goal is to have a child who grows into a fully functioning adult,
yeah,
who is emotionally balanced and looked after and has the right to know their genetic history, has the right to know who their siblings are and how close they are. And, you know, we need to prioritize the person and not the birth.
Because the birth is, it's essentially, it's a business, isn't it?
The fertility business is, yeah, it makes a lot of money.
You track down your file. How do you manage to do that?
So you couldn't time it, you know. Mm-hmm. I didn't speak about this until I found my half-sister, maybe 8 or so years ago. And when I met her, I just realized that I wanted to honor the relationship. I had waited so long to find her.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to ever be in a situation, say I got married, you know, and I was in a room with people and they said, oh, who's that? I didn't want to be like, oh, it's my friend, because it's not, it's my half-sister. I've waited half a lifetime to find this woman. She's amazing. So I wanted to really honor that relationship. And after I found her, I was like, well, I'm just going to start telling everyone. I'm going to start telling people I'm donor conceived.
And again, that you discover her through
online DNA testing. Exactly. I had to do it myself. I had to pay for it. I had to spit in a tube and send it off and hope for the best. And I was sitting on that DNA site for years before I got a match, you know, and that's painful as well. But when I found her, I realized I wanted to honor the relationship. And I wrote an article and, you know, I just got this huge feedback from all over the world of people going, you know, looking into the mirror and not knowing who half of you was. They get, well, no one's ever said it that way. You know, I've always felt it, but I haven't seen that written down before. And I realized there was such a space where these perspectives were just not being covered as a result of a lot of the shame that kind of exists in that space. And then I wanted to do a podcast and I started it during the pandemic when I had a bit of downtime. I'd just been made redundant. And as I was recording it, we got a match that led us to this man. So obviously it's me and my half-sister at this point. We're the only ones found. And we got a match that led us to him. And I, you know, again, after a decade and a half, suddenly in one night, you have a match that leads you to him. And within hours, I had found his website with the help of my half-sister. And I had a contact number. And I called him.
And what a rush that was to suddenly...
Yeah.
He had a website, so presumably there's a photograph...
There was a photograph. There was a video. He's a dance teacher. So there was a video of him dancing.
This is Jess, your half-sister.
Jess is my half-sister.
Did you discover this together? Were you sitting next to each other or were you remote from each other?
Yeah, no, we weren't together. The DNA match popped up on my side. So I got in touch with her and told her, I think I found a match that will bring us this way. And she... You know, she started digging. I'm the journalist, but honestly, like she went deep. She found him. She found him quickly. And he just looked like both of us, you know, like the title of my podcast, You Look Like Me. It's these things when you come face to face with a biological match, it's amazing what you see in yourself and mannerisms. It's not always physical, you know, it's just the way you move, the laugh. But yeah, we found him and I cold called him and, you know, we could have, we talked about, do you send an email? Could have sat there forever and back and forth about an email. And if it's right, if it's, you know, if he's going to respond to us, he'll do it, whether it's email, whether it's call. And people don't, you know. It's quicker with a phone call.
Because you're risking rejection, which can be hugely traumatic.
And also you get a rejection in real time, at least if it's a phone call, you know. Whereas if you send an email, you're just sitting there. It becomes a waiting game again, which is what I've been doing.
So you do it. You call.
I called him and I recorded the phone call because I didn't know if that was the only time I would speak to him. And Jess is, you know, live texting me, but she's never going to hear this man's voice if he says, I don't want to know you people.
Okay.
So I recorded the phone call, and he was amazing. He welcomed us. He is very spiritual, so he was very happy to be found. And we met up with him a month later, but he was happy for me to use some of that phone call in my podcast, with his permission, of course.
Wow.
So that has been an amazing resource for people who are donor conceived, who may want to reach out, who can see that it's possible, see what the language is, see how taken aback someone who was a donor when he donated. He was never given a choice to not be anonymous.
He was going about his business that day. And
he was on a beach in Greece,
really?
You know, and he gets a phone call from someone saying, I think I'm your daughter. By the way, there's another one.
Wow. What was his reaction?
He said, you've caught me by surprise, but you are very, very welcome to have found me.
If there's a good place to be.
Yeah.
it's a beach on Greece.
Well, exactly. Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
He's obviously assuming there are people because he's donated his sperm.
Yeah, but he never thought about it. He never, ever thought about it, which is shocking now because he's so happy to be found and so open to it. But he never thought that he should sign up, you know. So he's been a great resource as well. You know, obviously my podcast is about donor-conceived people, but brings in all manner of experiences. And we do have donors who speak, and we do have, you know, recipient parents. My own parents are on it. And, you know...
This is Neil, by the way.
This is
your biological father.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You've kind of got some sort of a relationship with him now.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and that's strange in itself because I didn't want another father. I had the best father. You know, I still have the best father, but he was wonderful growing up. You know, there was never a lack there. But I just, maybe it's my journalist hat, maybe it's the desire to know where we come from. And the huge feeling of injustice that I had a right to know where I came from. So, finding him, it just answered a lot of questions that, funnily enough, had been semi-answered by finding Jess. You know, okay. Even that one biological match was important, and it did answer a lot. When I found her, I did think, you know, maybe this is enough for me. But finding him has been great, yeah. And we are building to a relationship. I don't know what the relationship, how would you define it? I don't really know. But I am cautious that through this podcast and through telling this story, I am really in the minority of people who come out of these things with a happy
finding
ending.
Finding out, okay.
Finding out or finding out and being accepted.
And be accepted.
You know, people get restraining orders. As I mentioned earlier,
wow.
People find a donor to find out they've already passed away. There are horror stories that come out of this industry. And this is why, again, I would advocate for openness, honesty, allow people to track down these biological connections as early as possible, if they choose to. Many people might not.
There must be cases as well where it becomes quite hurtful to the parent who's not the biological parent any longer, and relationships must change with all the people you've met.
Yeah, you know, it is very difficult because, again, it's different now. People go into this knowing that the donor will not be anonymous after age 18,
mm-hmm.
You know. But again, that wasn't always the case. It was, this donor will be anonymous. And I can imagine, especially for people who don't tell their children that they're donor conceived, and then they find out accidentally, and then perhaps they go on and find a biological parent. But honestly, the vast majority of us, you know, we are just not looking for a parental role. We're not looking for another parent. We just want those answers.
There's a missing piece in your life there.
There's missing information.
Right.
Yeah, for sure.
It went well for you. Does Neil, your dad, your biological father, does he know how many children have been born from his?
We have absolutely
donation.
No idea. So I have found, seven half siblings, I think.
Seven?
Yes, so far.
And have you been in contact with all of them?
No.
You just know that they exist out there?
Yes. There's been a recent discovery, which was three at once, which was a lot, but we have not been in contact with them. But I have spoken to people, you know, episode two of my podcast, I speak to a teenager who has 200 plus half siblings.
Wow. I presume that's in America.
That is in America.
It's highly commercialized.
Oh, it's the Wild West over there. And there's no legislation there on a kind of, you know, countrywide level.
Mm.
But, you know, the numbers do get insane. And you should never, ever be put in a situation where you are creating a human being who is going to have more siblings than they have friends. I don't have 200 friends. And I certainly could not keep up with 200 half siblings.
That would be a challenge.
Yeah.
For sure. Christmas would be very traumatic.
Yeah, and expensive.
Very expensive. There is a huge, there's been a huge change, hasn't there, in terms of DNA. The DNA does not lie. And it was sitting there. I presume the clinics are quite happy when there weren't any of these genealogical sites. And I know there are ethical issues around those sites where you send a swab of your DNA off in the post to companies which have been then snapped up by pharmaceutical companies, obviously. Mm-hmm. So you're suddenly your family history story has become something else.
Yeah.
You're critical of the legislation around that as well, I think.
Well, I'm critical in that I say it doesn't go far enough. I do think steps are going in the right direction. Again, you know, removing anonymity for donors is excellent. Mm-hmm. But age 18, it doesn't make sense for me. It's arbitrary. You know, it's been selected because it's like, oh, well, you're unofficially an adult now. But again, the pain that I sat through as a teenager with no way of getting any answers, I don't know why we're inflicting that on people. You know?
You kind of advised your parents of donor-conceived children just to tell the story the whole way along?
That's not just my advice. It's my experience. It's coming from other donor-conceived people I've spoken to. I would say 99.9%. And yeah, but it's also the advice from people who are doing recent studies, who are looking into the emotional impact of not knowing this information and then finding out later in life, whether you're told, whether you find out. The advice is absolutely tell from day one. And that is not used to shame people who have not yet chosen, because it has been unclear previously.
Yeah.
But the advice is, if you have a donor-conceived child and they do not know, no matter what age, that conversation really does need to happen.
There's somebody in on that very thought. I welcomed my daughter in 2024, thanks to donor sperm. She will know from day one her story. We already read books on the kind man who gave the gift to our family, and I will support her decision to seek him out or not when she is older,
yes,
as per the legislation, which we'll cover.
Yes, I love that. And this is the thing. When I advocate for this, people go, well, they're a child. You know, how will they understand that? That is a perfect example of, you know, a book has been written for this very purpose, to help a child understand. You do it in an age-appropriate way.
There's no disturbing shock that happens.
No, I mean, my sister, she grew up, she's got two mums, so she knew this was her reality the whole time. There was never any jarring moment for her. People who know from day one fare better emotionally.
The rules right now, the dramatic change came around 2020, was it? So does that mean there are still people in limbo like yourself, because it's not retrospective?
Exactly. Yes, exactly. Many of us are still relying on commercial DNA sites. Many of us will never get information. Again, you know, you asked how many siblings I have. I have no idea. It could be, you know, my biological father donated to one clinic, two clinics. The first four that he found were all from different clinics. We were being shared out, you know, without...
Right.
Yeah. So there was just no legislation. There was no legislation. Okay. Wow. So again, step in
shared at a profit.
Yeah. Well, exactly. Yeah. So
I think the update to legislation is that there can be non-identifying information on their donor when people turn 16 here in Ireland. But that non-identifying, I think, is just roughly an area of the country. I mean, it doesn't give you the...
Yeah, to me... That's kind of lip service. It's fairly useless. Again, you know, you can, I think the law on kind of information that you can get about half siblings, again, you can find out the year of birth and their gender. That's going to be half your class. You know, that doesn't help me identify who my half sibling is in any way. You know,
it might make you yearn for more.
Yeah, it's just not usable information.
The person, the donor conceived child turning 18, they still have the option to do nothing.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So what we need to start doing is putting the power in the hands of the donor conceived people. All of this, again, these are the only people who did not sign this contract, but they need the power to make these choices about, you know, do they want this information? Do they not? A lot of the time they might not. If they're told from day one, might not be bothered.
Is there still a taboo around, the issue of donor conceived children?
I think it's being broken down. And, you know, when I started my podcast, there was nothing like it. You know, like, it really did give a voice to donor conceived people that I don't think previously existed. It was very hard to get people to come on my podcast originally. There was a trust element because I am donor conceived myself. And as the episodes moved through, that grew and it became easier for people to speak. But that people did not want to be identifiable because there was a shame. And a lot of the time, they just don't want to hurt their parents. That's what this comes back to.
Yeah.
The shame on many levels starts there. So, you know, not to pat myself on the back, but I do think that the podcast has helped. But I do need to, you know, recognize that actually the work of other people in the fertility realm has helped a lot as well. People who are speaking out, not necessarily about like donor conception, but about their own fertility struggles. There are so many podcasts on that now. That's removing stigma. And the stigma around donation comes from the stigma around fertility. And if people at a base level who are using these services are helping to break down that stigma, you know, that's what we want. I was talking to another donor-conceived person around a year ago, and they said something about someone in the playground said that they were donor-conceived to them, and it was just like part of their story.
It's normal.
I was like, that is amazing.
That's a leaps and bounds, isn't it?
That is a different universe to what I grew up with.
And were there some concerns around this because of this, prior to this change, that maybe being the risk of being identified when the person turns 18, that might turn off people who donate sperm?
Absolutely, and it absolutely does. You know, as donor conception, you know, the 2025 budget is now expanding free IVF to people who will be using a donor.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's becoming more commonplace. We do need sperm, we do need eggs. And yes, of course, like being identifiable will turn people off. But that's just the cost that you have to pay when all the research and all the firsthand evidence is saying that donor conceived people deserve the right to know. What it has also done is some parents, some recipient parents, potential parents are still resistant to the idea of a identifiable donor. What it has done is push certain people onto the likes of Facebook groups, kind of underground sperm donation, for example. It gets dark very quickly. I could come on and talk to you for another hour about that, and we just don't have time to go that deep. But it is a very dark, murky world where men really control the narrative and the situation.
Right, it's the manosphere.
Yeah, and have you, you know, nightmares. Think of, you know, Man with 1,000 Kids, for example. It's kind of, you're going into that space. This law change and this guidance exists for a reason, and if, you know, anonymous sperm donation for the sake of your child and their health emotionally and physically, anonymity is just not the way to go.
Right, it's keeping it open. Well, it's an interesting topic, absolutely fascinating, Louise. Thank you so much for chatting to us. You Look Like Me is the podcast, and you hear the stories of donor-conceived kids like yourself and how they find out and what their search is like and how it's ongoing. And that's available wherever you get your podcasts, basically.
Exactly, yes.
But Louise McLaughlin, thank you so much for coming in to us, and good luck out there in the cold weather.
Thank you.
You're based in London, aren't you, so you're going back?
I am. I'm here for another few days, but yes, I'll be back to London soon.
Take care. Safe travels.
Email Oliver at rte.ie.